I'm Tammy.
I'm Althea.
I'm Sonia.
And I hope that you have a fantastic rest of the week. End? This is the weekend.
It's the weekend, you guys. Finished. It's Friday. Fall apart.
Good advice. Thank you so much for that. It's Friday. Fall apart.
Are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on Portland Dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's fall membership drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thanks to listeners like you, KBOO is able to continue to provide a platform for underserved groups, neglected perspectives, and grassroots journalism. Thank you. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to the Got Science Podcast. I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Today's podcast is airing on Election Day, and here at Podcast Central, we're out voting, volunteering, and helping to safely get out the vote. So we're switching things up and starting off with the final installment of our four-part series on how rigorous science and a little detective work can provide evidence to make polluters pay. We'll then follow up with an episode we ran a while back about the trustworthiness of science. This is part four of our series on climate accountability brought to you by Katie Love. If you missed the first three, you can find them in episodes 93 through 95. To recap, we've learned that it's illegal for companies to lie about the harm their products cause. And despite that, fossil fuel companies spread lies for decades about climate change, which they knew was caused by burning their products. Last episode, Katie brought the science to show that we can now tie the effects of climate change to specific fossil fuel companies. And today, we're coming back around to justice. Here's Katie.
Thanks, Colleen. So,
Now that we know that climate change costs communities billions of dollars in damages, for example, after a destructive storm made worse or more likely by warming, and we know it costs billions more to cover preventative and adaptive measures, such as seawalls to prevent flooding, and we know it costs lives, like when people die during heat waves, and we know that the effects of climate change hurt communities of color and low-income communities the most, is it fair that communities have to keep covering these costs? Is it fair that companies selling products that they know contribute to climate change have lied about the harm they've done? Is it fair that these companies have billions of dollars and outsized political influence, but have pinned the responsibility for climate change on us? Of course not. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to rely on fossil fuel companies or our government to do what's fair. Under these circumstances, what recourse is there for justice? And that's actually one idea, going through the justice system. That's why this summer, Connecticut, Delaware, and Minnesota joined about 20 other U.S. cities, counties, and states in filing climate change lawsuits against fossil fuel companies. Many of these cases seek to hold companies liable for damages caused by climate change impacts. Some of them allege that specific companies violated consumer protection and common laws by defrauding residents with false advertising and misrepresentation. Many of these lawsuits include details in their filings about how the impacts of climate change hit heaviest on those who can least afford it. For example, the city of Charleston, South Carolina, noted that people of color and those living in poverty are more vulnerable to extreme heat events, which are projected to increase in the decades ahead. The city of Hoboken, New Jersey, pointed to the inequitable impacts of Hurricane Sandy, which trapped residents living in low-income housing as the streets flooded around them. Delaware's filing mentions urban heat islands, which worsen the health impacts of extreme heat on communities of color and low-income communities. Climate lawsuits can be a means to advance racial and economic justice for those who are disproportionately affected. And they're not limited to the United States. Over the past 5 years, the Philippines Commission on Human Rights conducted an investigation into the responsibility of the world's biggest polluters for human rights violations resulting from climate change. The commission found that major fossil fuel companies could be found legally and morally liable for climate-related human rights harms to Filipinos, but has not yet released its final report. It's expected by the end of this year, and it could help inform other countries' consideration of corporate climate accountability. I mentioned a study by Yale University in the last episode. That study found that a majority of Americans surveyed in 2019 think that fossil fuel companies are at least partly responsible for climate change impacts, and that they should pay for at least some of the damages to communities. Public opinion on this topic is shifting as the consequences of climate change become harder to ignore, and the science linking these impacts to specific companies develops. The lawsuits I described represent the beginning of a battle in courts worldwide over accountability and liability for climate change. In addition to cases that aim to hold corporations accountable for their contributions to climate change, climate litigation also targets governments at all levels, seeking to compel them to protect the rights of people, future generations, and the environment from disruptive climate change. I invite you to visit the UCS Science Hub for Climate Litigation to learn more about the science behind making polluters pay. It's on our site at act.ucsusa.org/science-hub. And stay tuned to our blog for updates on these legal cases. Thanks for joining me for this series.
And now we're rewinding back to episode 70, which first aired on October 22nd, 2019. Science historian Dr. Naomi Oreskes made the case for why we can and should trust science. Naomi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
I had the pleasure of reading an advanced copy of your book, and I found it super interesting and also really accessible to the non-scientist. I wanted to start a little bit with the history. So when I think of how modern science is practiced, For me, it conjures the idea of the scientific method, some set of principles or a system that scientists adhere to, and it's the primary way that we know science is trustworthy. So I found the first chapter in your book really fascinating because it takes us through the progression of science from the individual scientist, where the reputation of the man of science was what made us trust the science, to our current system, which is more collaborative. So can you give us a brief history of that transformation and how things unfolded?
Sure. So I think most of us were raised with the vision of science that you just described, that there was this thing called the scientific method, singular, and that science was reliable by virtue of the fact that scientists used that method. But what we've learned over the past 100 years of history and philosophy of science, and also sociology of science, anthropology of science, is that that picture is incorrect. It's false both on a philosophical level, but it's also just not, it's not what scientists actually do. So if we look at what scientists do, we see it's very diverse. There are lots of different methods that scientists use. But that creates a new question. Well, if scientists use a lot of different methods, if there isn't one unique singular scientific method, then how or why is science reliable? And that was the question that I wanted to answer in this book.
So what did we start off with?
It's an interesting thing that many people think, well, science, you know, used to just be individual scientists, typically men. But actually, that's not true. If we go back to the earliest days of what we could recognize as modern science, we find that science has always been collaborative. There have always been scientific societies, organizations like the Royal Society in England or the Académie des Sciences in France. These collaborative organizations are places where people would bring their ideas and their evidence to bear and present their claims in front of a group of peers, other scientists, other men of learning, or savants, as they were sometimes referred to in France. And that was a crucial thing because it was in that process of bringing evidence into an audience of peers and having those colleagues look at the evidence, debate the claims, argue about them. That's where we see the emergence of what I would say is, in fact, science. And that's the piece that, as historians, we can identify as the one consistent thing that we can follow all the way back to the 17th century.
So I think I'll ask you the question that is the title of the book. How then can we trust science?
Right. Well, so the question, why trust science, came out of a public lecture that I gave many years ago. For many years, I've been lecturing on the history of climate science. And so one time I gave a lecture, it was a very finely crafted lecture with lots of good slides and lots of telling detail. And at the end of it, a man stood up, put his fists on his hips and said, "Well, that's all very well and good, professor, but why should we trust the science?" And I stood there for a moment. I thought, well, that's a good question. Fair enough. So this book is an attempt to answer that question. And the short version is, it's not because of a unique scientific method, and it's not because of who scientists are as individuals. It's not because they're particularly smart or particularly moral or anything like that. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But it's because scientists have means of evaluating claims, of vetting claims, and subjecting those claims to critical scrutiny. And it's that collective or social process of critical scrutiny which I argue is the thing that yields reliable knowledge.
So you give a good analogy in the book about how we decide we can trust a plumber, and that maybe we could use the same sort of criteria for evaluating whether or not we should trust a scientist. And that sort of resonated with me. It really made sense. So can you tell us that analogy?
Sure. Well, I'm glad it resonated because one of the things I try to do in this book, of course, is to think about examples from ordinary life that we're all familiar with. Because one of the problems of science is that there's this mystification of science, and that can be very alienating. It can make science seem like something we can't understand. So if we think about it, there are many people in our lives whose expertise we trust. So whether it's your plumber, your dentist, your car mechanic, well, we'll get back to the plumber, right? Because that's an example almost all of us have had. Why do we trust a plumber to do our plumbing? It's because we know the plumber has specialized training. We know he or she has specialized tools. And hopefully, if it's a decent plumber, has experience doing the job that needs to be done. So what I'm arguing is that scientists are the plumbers of knowledge, right? These are the people who in our society have the training, the expertise, and the experience to answer questions about the natural world. Now, I'm not saying we should trust them blindly. So just as with a plumber, you would ask friends for advice. You would check the reputation, maybe go online and read the reviews. So we do judge people by their track records. And in the case of science, if we judge science by its track record, we see that the track record is very, very good.
So what do we do in instances where science was wrong?
So the question of track record, of course, invites us to look more closely at the track record of science. And so in the book, I argue that if we do that, we actually see that the track record of science is amazingly good. The cases where we can identify scientists, trained expert scientists, going wrong are actually not that common, but it's very telling to look at them in detail. So in the second chapter in the book, that's what I do. And what we find in these cases that I look at here is that, for the most part, what we discover is that actually there wasn't a scientific consensus, that in these cases there actually was informed debate and dissent even at the time. My favorite example in the case is this story of the limited energy theory.
Yes.
And this was a case that a student of mine, Kate Bateman, wrote her master's degree on many years ago. So the limited energy theory is an amazing story. I really wish some filmmaker would call me and we could make a movie about this, because it's such a great story and almost no one knows about it. In the late 19th century, a physician here at Harvard, a professor of medicine, Edward Clark, wrote a book called Sex and Education. And in this book, he claimed that if women were educated, and particularly if they were subject to the rigors of higher education, that their reproductive organs would shrink and they would become infertile. You're smiling. The audience can't see. You're smiling. Right. I mean, so in hindsight, from the perspective of today, the obvious sexism and gender bias of this is pretty clear to us, but it wasn't obvious and clear to everyone in the late 19th century. The book was very successful. It was a bestseller, went through multiple editions, and it was so successful that women who were involved in pioneering higher education at that time, because this is the time when many women's colleges were founded in America, Smith, Vassar, Radcliffe, Bryn Mawr, the women who were involved in these colleges had to fight against a widespread popular belief that this theory was correct. And it was presented as a deduction from scientific theory, specifically from conservation of energy. So most of us know, if you remember any of your high school science, conservation of energy says that in any closed system, there's a finite amount of energy. So if we use energy for one thing, like getting educated, we have less energy for something else, like reproduction. But looking back, there's an obvious flaw in this theory, which is, well, if that's true, why doesn't it apply to men? And particularly, Dr. Clark insisted that women's uterus would shrink. But he never asked the question, well, what part of men's anatomy would shrink? So there's a kind of obvious asymmetry in this. But nevertheless, it could have been the case that all scientists accepted this theory, in which case we would have to say, well, here's an example of scientists saying something that in hindsight we would think is ridiculous and obviously biased. But the fact is, scientists didn't all think that. There were many people who objected at the time, including an important woman physician, Mary Putnam Jacobi. Mary Putnam Jacobi pointed out many of the obvious flaws in this theory, including that his sample size was tiny, 7 patients, and a whole lot of other mistakes as well, a whole lot of other methodological problems.
Maybe this is a naive question, but were they able to look at a uterus and see if it was in fact smaller?
Correct, exactly. So one of the methodological problems of this theory is that in effect what he was doing was using the hypothetical deductive model, which many people think of as being the scientific method. He had a hypothesis deriving from conservation of energy. He deduces a consequence, which is that women's reproductive organs would shrink. But if you're really going to follow the hypothetical deductive model, then you have to test to see whether that hypothesis is true. And he never did. He had no empirical evidence to support the claim that the uterus would shrink. So it was a very small sample. It was a biased sample. And he had no independent confirmation of the central claim.
You know what's really interesting about that, though, is when you read one of the other case studies, the birth control one, where there was so much information from women who were experiencing depression from taking the birth control pills, but yet the mountains of stories that women were telling weren't really taken into account.
Right. So one of the important lessons of this, two of my cases involve the discounting of the views or evidence from women. And so in the first case, the limited energy theory, we have a woman physician pointing out these obvious large methodological mistakes in Clark's work. But for some reason, it took a woman to do that, even though one might have thought that an intelligent man could have seen those errors as well. In the second case, which is the contraceptive pill, there we have large amounts of evidence that the contraceptive pill was in fact causing depression in women who were taking it. But that evidence was discounted by predominantly male physicians who did not consider the evidence from patients self-reporting to be reliable. So there's two lessons I draw from that. One of the arguments I make is that evidence comes in many different forms. And sometimes evidence is not in the form that you would like to have. So physicians or biomedical researchers, they would prefer to have double-blind clinical trials.
Just tell us what a double-blind trial is.
Sure. A double-blind trial means, let's say I have a new drug and I want to compare it to an existing drug or to a placebo. I take two groups of people who hopefully are similar in all other respects. One group gets the new drug, the other gets the old drug or the placebo. But they don't know which one they're getting. So there can't be sort of wishful thinking bias effects. And moreover, the person giving them the drug doesn't know either, because we know from lots of research that if I know who's getting which, there might be subtle cues that people would pick up on. So the person giving the drug doesn't know the person receiving the drug. If you can do it, that's a very good thing to do, because we know psychological bias is real and in some cases can be a very large effect. But you can't always do a double-blind trial. If a woman is taking the birth control pill, she has to know that, right? So you can't do a double-blind trial. Similarly, nutrition. You can't do double-blind trials of nutrition because people know what they're putting in their mouths. So if you can't do a double-blind trial, it doesn't mean that you throw up your hands and say, well, we're just completely ignorant. No, there are other things you can rely on, and they may not be ideal, but they still might be useful. And so in this case, I argue that the women's self-reports, their own experience of this drug, should have been taken as important information, possibly imperfect, but not nothing. And instead, the vast majority of physicians, scientists discounted this evidence and kept insisting that the pill was safe, kept insisting that it did not cause mental health effects, even though we now know beyond any reasonable doubt that in fact it does. So that's a case for arguing for a certain kind of open-mindedness about evidence and not succumbing to what I call methodological fetishism, to say that if I can't have it exactly this way, then I don't want it at all, or if it's not a double-blind clinical trial, then I just discount it completely. And that issue comes up in one of my other examples, which is the dental floss case. So we saw not that long ago, some listeners may remember, there was a lot of attention in the mass media to the claim that dental floss was no use.
But like the great dental floss
scam.
Scam, right.
The military industrial dental floss complex, right? Right. So in that case, again, we actually had a lot of evidence about the efficacy of dental floss, but again, not in a double-blind trial, because obviously you know if you're flossing or not. But the reporters who reported on it claimed that there was no evidence or no, quote, no good evidence. But what they were missing was the idea that, okay, maybe it wasn't the best possible evidence, but it's still evidence.
And I did notice that you maybe were advocating for professional flossers that could come in and help people floss their teeth properly.
Well, right, because one of the things you learn in science is often the devil's in the details. And so it turns out one of the reasons why dental flossing is confusing is because it's what dentists call a technique-sensitive intervention, which means it depends on how well you do it. And it turns out a lot of us don't floss very well. We don't take enough time.
And we lie about it.
We're not honest. We claim we're flossing when we're not. And also children, for flossing to be most effective, you want to start young, because it's children who tend to get the most cavities. And children often don't do it right, just because their hands are small, they don't have good dexterity. But in one study where they actually had professional dental hygienists flossing the teeth of children, they saw dramatic positive effects. So I say it's slightly tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely. What this tells us is that how you do something is often as important as whether or not you do it. So, yes, I imagine a world where next to Starbucks there could be like a little dental flossing bar where you could just pop in and for $5 have a quick flossing, and we would have much better dental health.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and all the usual podcast outlets. For a transcript or links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. Now let's get back to our interview. So what is the role of diversity in science? Because the examples that we just talked about, obviously, as a woman, those examples might lead me to not be as trusting of science. And I think one of your other examples brings into question people of color with the eugenics example. So why should I, as a woman or a person of color, trust science?
One of the things you have a right to ask is this community diverse? Because if it turns out that the scientific community is all white men, then as a woman or a person of color, you might actually have a right to be a little skeptical and to look closely and not just assume that the finding is robust. But if you see that the community is diverse, if there's good evidence that people have really had a chance to speak freely, that the processes of critical interrogation have really been taking place, then yes, we should trust science. And the good thing about that, in my opinion, is those are questions we can ask. So for example, I deal a lot with climate science. There are people who are skeptical of climate science, but they could take my model and they could say, all right, well, let's look at the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Is it diverse? Are there men and women? Are there people from all across the world, people from rich countries and poor countries? Have they looked at this problem from many different angles? Have they collected many different kinds of evidence? So it actually gives you a set of criteria that you can apply in any case, whether it's climate change, vaccinations, evolution. And so my argument is, in a way, it's an empowering argument for citizens. It's giving us, in a way, a kind of checklist that we could use as ordinary people to say, okay, I'm going to ask these questions and I have a right to ask these questions. But if the answer is yes, they are diverse, they have looked at it from many different angles, then I should say, okay, then I'm probably justified to trust them. And it doesn't mean that science is perfect. It doesn't mean that there won't be cases where, for whatever reason, we learn in the future that things are different. But it means that in a given moment, this is probably the best we can do.
Well, you set me up for my next question here perfectly. So, Naomi, if I asked you to create a handy card for me that would fit in my wallet, kind of like Seafood Watch, where you can pull it out and see what kind of seafood you should eat, and it had bullet points on it that would remind me what to keep in mind when deciding if the science is trustworthy, what would you put on that list?
Number one, is the scientific community diverse? So the community of experts involved in this, is it diverse? That, to me, is the single most important thing. Second, have they looked at this problem from a number of different angles? Have they collected data, different kinds of data, and have different groups of people been involved, independent groups of people involved in collecting that data? And then the third thing I would say is, has this work been going on for a bit of time? Because the other thing we've learned through our research is that it does take time for scientists to sort out complicated things. Some of the issues that I've looked at were debated for 10, 20, 30 years before the scientific community came to agreement. So if something is a very new question, then I think we're right to possibly withhold judgment. And the fourth thing is consensus. Is there general agreement now among the scientific community on this issue, or is there still significant dissent within the scientific community? And that's a crucial modifier, because there'll always be people outside the community who are disagreeing because their financial interests are threatened or their ideology is threatened. But if scientists, people inside the scientific community, are raising questions, then that's something we should listen to. But if scientists have come to agreement and there is a consensus, then that's telling us that, again, it may not be perfect, but it's probably the best information we have to hand right now.
The dental floss example that you use and the looming climate crisis, it makes me want to end with Pascal's wager. So can you tell our listeners what that is? And then I was hoping you might read a short excerpt from the book.
Pascal was an important French philosopher and mathematician who several centuries ago raised the question, should we believe in God or not? And as a scientist, he wanted to try to come up with a scientific proof for the existence of God. And after many years and much thought on this issue, he concluded that that was not possible. But what you could do was you could think about it in probabilistic terms. And he came up with a concept that has come to be known as Pascal's wager. He argued, well, think of it this way. If I believe in God and it turns out there is no God, there's really not much harm done there. But if I choose not to believe in God and God really does exist, then I'm in deep, deep trouble and I'm going to burn in hell for eternity. So it's obvious, if you think of it from a rational, logical, probabilistic standpoint, that we must believe in God and hope for the best. So that notion of Pascal's wager can be applied to any problem, including the problem of climate change. And so in the book, I come to a conclusion about how we can apply this to questions about our own decision-making, whether it's dental floss, vaccination, or acting on climate change. And so I write, no matter how well-established scientific knowledge is, no matter how strong the expert consensus, there will always be residual uncertainty. For this reason, if our scientific knowledge is being challenged, for whatever reason, we might take a lead from Pascal and ask, what are the relative risks of ignoring scientific claims that turn out to be true versus acting on claims that turn out to be false? The risks of not flossing are real, but not inordinate. The risks of not acting on the scientific evidence of climate change are inordinate.
Well, thank you, Naomi, for joining me. I really enjoyed the book, and I'm hoping that all of our listeners will pick up a copy and read it, because it's really accessible to the average person like me.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. Learn more at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to Professor Naomi Oreskes. Our four-part series on climate accountability was brought to you by Katie Love. Editing and music by Brian Middleton. Additional editing by Omari Spears. Research and writing by Pamela Wirth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Come find us on Twitter at GotScienceUCS. Thanks. Stay safe and see you next time.
Good morning, this is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
Today in the studio with me is Sabine Rear from the AT Lab with Community Vision. Good morning, Sabine.
Good morning, John. Hi, everybody. Yep, my name is Sabine Rear, and I'm the accessibility specialist at the Assistive Technology Lab at Community Vision.
Interesting. What is the AT Lab?
So the AT Lab, or Assistive Technology Lab, is a showroom space that is meant to allow people the opportunity to come into contact with, check out, and get help setting up and using assistive technology. And just for anybody who's not familiar with that term, we consider assistive technology to be any kind of tool or technology that helps people with disabilities engage with any aspect of their life, whether that be work or leisure or navigating their home, mobility, and lots of folks use assistive tech in a variety of ways. As a blind person, I move around the world with a cane, which I would consider assistive tech. Some people use, we instruct people in things like software to help with reading and writing. We're doing a lot of supports for folks who are engaging with distance learning now for the first time. Smart home technology to help people interact with the appliances and fixtures in their homes. Speech technology for folks who don't use natural speech, all kinds of stuff. So that's the brief assistive tech definition, and the AT lab has been around for coming up on 2 years now here, built into Community Vision's beautiful, super accessible Seven Corners Collaborative, which John and Dina, I know y'all have visited me at last year when we were allowed to visit each other in places.
Yeah, it was nice to see somebody in person. I sure am starting to miss that. I am wondering, do you also deal with people's wheelchairs as well?
Generally, that's something we make referrals for, because wheelchairs are such a specialized type of tech and really individualized to the person. The showroom is meant to give people an idea of what's out there, but you know, if we were to have all the assistive tech in the world, we'd be bigger than the biggest warehouse. So one big role that we have is providing referrals and helping people get to the specialized stuff that they need. So when someone's looking for a chair, or a chair mount, something large like that, we can consult and make recommendations, but we have one chair in the space for people to look at, but generally we want them to get down to as specific a tool as they can for something as integral to life as mobility.
So you guys work on the smaller tech, not the larger tech, like if somebody needs a specialized bed or something else of that nature, you'd refer them to a different area.
Yeah, we just don't have the space to accommodate stuff like that. But yeah, always increasing the number of business cards we have to pass on to people and referrals. That's a big part of our work.
And it's nice to know for people who might walk in and think can help them out with their wheelchairs.
Yeah, we definitely, we do what we can. And Carrie, one of our directors, who is our occupational therapist, definitely has some experience working on chairs, and we have some mounts that people can try for their devices. But yes, I think that is definitely something that we generally pass along to a referral who's better suited to help with that.
All right. By the way, how are you doing today? I mean, getting off topic for just a minute. How has this pandemic been affecting you, Sabine, personally? I mean, you've said that you are visually impaired, and I'm just kind of like wondering, were you probably doing Zoom and all this other stuff long before we were all forced to do it? Or is this all kind of really like new to you and you're just like, oh man, do I have to adapt?
This is all new. I definitely, I have to take a lot of screen breaks. I was working in the lab before where I wouldn't have to look at the screen all the time. Biggest impact for me is that as a blind person, obviously I don't drive. And because we work with a medically fragile population, I'm trying not to take the bus, trying to avoid places that seem like high risk for picking something up. So my world has gotten really small. I'm kind of living only in the spaces that I can access on foot, which is okay, but weird. And then on a personal note, I mean, I'm a very social person. My partner is a more introverted person. And so he's working upstairs. He's doing just fine with this, but I'm like really, I'm struggling. It's much, my disposition is less well suited to hanging out in the house. It's hard to be stuck in your house all the time, but yeah, it's definitely been, because I can't see very far, I wear a mask all the time. I'm not like, I won't see people within the 6 feet, right? So I want to make sure that I'm doing my due diligence, not making anybody nervous.
I want to thank you for giving us an insight.
Yeah, no, that's happy to share. And
what is your position in the lab?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so I've been at the lab for about a year now, and my title is Accessibility Specialist. And I actually hold two kind of complementing positions. So my time is split between my work in the lab, which is my office all the time, as the accessibility specialist. And then also I am the sort of executor of a contract. Community Vision has a contract with the Northwest ADA Center, which is our regional ADA information center. And I answer questions about the ADA for them as well as their technical assistance specialist. But since we're here to talk about the lab, just to say my work with the ADA Center helps me be able to answer more questions, have sort of knowledge coming from two sides.
Yeah, for those who may not know what ADA is, could you say it, you know, we use a lot of acronyms or alphabets, and some people just don't know what it means.
Absolutely. And I made a note to myself to not use any acronyms today without explaining them. So thank you very much. The Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, is the single biggest piece of civil rights legislature put into place in 1990, covering and protecting the rights of people with disabilities in public space and employment. And for your listeners' edification, I'll say that the federally, it's mandated that each region have an information center. So that's what the Northwest ADA Center does. We provide peer information in as unbiased a way as possible. We don't give legal advice or do advocacy, but we make referrals and help people get the information that they need regarding the ADA in order to make decisions, whether that's business owners, people with disabilities, advocates, state or local governments. So that's what that work entails.
So you have a lot more information than just the tech lab to give out.
Yes, yeah, and they often pair well together. So I'm happy to get to combine those knowledge sets to give people the information that they need.
That's nice to know.
Yeah.
Please go on with, did we finish up with what?
Yeah, let me just briefly, as the accessibility specialist, my role is to support the directors. So we're a team of three. The AT Lab was opened by our pair of directors, Kim Elliott and Carrie Luce, who are a speech pathologist and a OT, or occupational therapist, respectively. So within the lab, they do consultations, both paid and pro bono, depending on the situation. They also execute the grants that support us and our operation. And together we manage the open hours and provide information on the phone line and also in person during normal times about AT. So my role is to support them. I run our open hours when we have them. And lately I've been doing the administrative work around our loan program, which is a program that we recently launched that allows us to let people borrow assistive tech that we have in the lab and try it out to help them make an informed decision about tech that they might want to purchase or get purchased for them. So that's been the bulk of my work lately.
So, loan program. About what items can people check out? How long can they check them out for? And what is the liability if it should get damaged outside the lab?
Absolutely. So our loan program is brand new, funded by the Reeve Foundation. We're really excited to be working on it. We have a growing loan closet right now. The types of tech we have span from iPads, Chromebook, tools like that, eye gaze and head mouse devices, down to switches, keyboard stands, adaptive keyboards and mice, key guards for people using iPads. And yeah, so it's quite a wide variety. On our website, we have information about what we loan. And to the point of liability, we allow people to borrow items on an inquiry basis for 2 weeks. During the loan process, we do ask that folks, as a requirement for a loan, sign a liability form that they will take on fiscal responsibility for any damaged or lost items. So that is a required element of the loan process. All that's established up front.
How did you get your position?
Great question. So like I said, I've been with the lab for a year now. It actually was my jobiversary just last week, which was very exciting. I came to this position from the school district. I had been an administrative assistant with the school district for a couple of years and was looking for a position that would connect me with my community a little bit more and allow me to work more directly with both the community that I was part of and just support the Portland community in general more directly. I would say that I got this position both because I have a lot of administrative skills that have been really well aligned with the projects that Kim and Carrie have wanted to do in the lab. And I've been able to support that based on those strengths and also based on my unpaid work. I do a lot of work both for myself and for community organizations outside of my paid time. And then also because I come to this job with lived experience as a person with a disability. And I think that was something that they were happy to have represented in the lab. Outside of this work, I'm also an organizer with the Portland Zine Symposium and an artist. So a lot of my work around both that organizing and maintaining my personal artistic and general like creative engagement, I think was a strength that I bring to the lab and to my administrative work.
And then you said you're an artist on top of this. I'm going to be a little bit curious because I like art myself. And so, you know, I'm kind of curious, what kind of artist are you?
Yeah, I'm a cartoonist. I draw black and white autobiographical comics, mostly about disability in public space, sometimes about pro wrestling. And I got into that just as I was finishing school. When I was in college, I did some work around women's studies and disability studies and was trying to figure out how I could best convey the things that I learned and the things that I was grappling with in a way that was accessible, in a way that would make sense to other people. And I learned about zines. I was introduced to the Independent Publishing Resource Center, which you may be familiar with. I know that Rachel is also a friend of the IPRC. If folks aren't familiar with it, it's a wonderful self-publishing space here in Portland. So I was introduced to the IPRC, started making zines, really enjoyed the handmade aspect and the sort of creative control of writing and drawing you know, the ability to, as a visually impaired person, like work in black and white and express my own sort of experience with aesthetics and visual experience. So that's something that I've also been doing for about 5 years now. I completed a certificate program at the IPRC around self-publishing and then went on to teach it. This would have been the end of my first year teaching there, but unfortunately the pandemic has made it such that my students were unable to complete their in-person work. So someday we will all finish our comics and for now I'm, you know, stuck doodling inside.
So does that, you know, when you were talking about comics, I was thinking, oh, maybe you have something published. Maybe we've seen it out there. So you haven't published anything yet.
I've self-published quite a bit. So I've made handmade zines and they are available all over town. Less so now because I haven't had a chance to reprint anything. But yes, I have not done anything that you would find under the name of another publisher, but my work is out there.
It is out there. Do you know where, I mean, let's say somebody's a little bit interested in finding this work. Is there any stores or any locations you can give us that would enable us to purchase said items?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find links to my Etsy shop at my website, which is www.michaelsabine.com. But my stuff is also, I'm going to say these shops and I'm not sure how many of them are open, but at Powell's and at Bridge City Comics and I believe also at Books with Pictures on Division and at Floating World Comics. Again, all of that is dubious because I haven't had a chance to drop work off at any of these places in months. So the likelihood that they have a lot of it is slim, but it's been there. So those are places you could look.
When you say PALS, there are lots of PAL stores around. No offense. Mm-hmm. Which PALS would that be?
I believe the one on Burnside.
One on Burnside. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Boys, we are learning so much about you today.
What a treat.
Yeah, I just hope you don't mind sharing.
Oh, no, totally fine.
Okay, so just out of curiosity, we are kind of curious how the COVID-19 affected the lab.
Absolutely.
I know I asked you about your personal life, but
how yeah, and I tried to separate those things, knowing that we would talk about this too. So personal stuff aside, we have not been. So the lab has been closed after the shutdown order came down. You know, we serve a medically fragile population. We want to make sure people are safe. So we've been closed. Our open hours are not available. I go into the lab about once a week to tidy things up and manage the loan program. The way we're doing that in order to keep things safe is I'll go in and put together whatever items someone is borrowing and then just allow them to pick them up during those open hours, during the day that I'm there, contactless. And then, so I'm there to hand off and receive, but otherwise the lab is closed. We've been doing quite well with that. I'm quite proud. We were worried initially that launching the loan program right before a pandemic was going to be a problem, but I'm very proud of the way we've figured it out. And I think we've given people access to a lot of stuff that's wound up being even more helpful in the context of lockdown and sort of limited access. We've also been involved with a fair amount of support for folks, kiddos who are doing distance learning, because a lot of people are navigating the technology around distance learning and the specific access challenges that it poses for the first time. A lot of our sort of phone line conversations and a lot of the questions that we've been getting from community members have been around supporting distance learning for kids. So that's been a significant focus. We also are working to disperse through a grant we received from the CARES Act money. We are working to identify organizations who have clients who are in need of iPads to use as both assistive devices and to connect and avoid, you know, the sort of isolation that a lot of people are experiencing right now. So those have been some of our big projects, but the most important thing we want people to know is that our phone line is open, our email line is open, even though we can't see folks in person. Team and Carrie are still taking consultations. I'm still available to help with support around the loan program and around AT. So we're here and we miss seeing folks, but we're doing our best distantly.
So, and on that subject, I was kind of curious. You said that there's a no contact handoff. I'm wondering if that means you leave it at your back door inside the building, or is there like a spot for,
I assume we're kind of doing it on a case by case basis, depending on the level of complexity. So in some situations, someone's borrowing something that requires a little bit of instruction. So we, you know, put everything in a bag, wipe it down, leave the bag out, and then we have a distant conversation about any kind of onboarding information someone might need. This technology is often quite expensive and complex and specialized, so we're not like leaving it outside of the building.
And have you been using a lot of Zoom and Skype and Facebook Messenger and everything else like that?
Yep, lots and lots of Zoom. I believe the majority of Kim and Carrie's consultations are either by phone or by Zoom. And when we set up, you know, loan pickups or a loan form signings, things like that, a lot of that is either by phone or by Zoom, by email. Sort of crossing a lot of wires platform wise.
Our advocacy interactions, we've had to use, mostly we've been using Zoom, but there has been some discussion about using things like Skype or Facebook Messenger for various reasons, you know, like some of them will allow for closed caption automatically, and you know, I mean, there's different reasons to use different social medias, and I'm just kind of like wondering if you have to navigate multiple forms of social media, and if so, how are you dealing with using multiple interfaces on social media?
That's a great question. Yeah, luckily for the lab, social media isn't a big part of it. Carrie updates our Facebook, but we unless someone really needed to use a platform like Facebook, I think for the most part, people have been very comfortable using Zoom or using the phone. Honestly, using the phone is great. Getting a break from the screen has been really nice. So I've enjoyed opportunities where people have, like my ADA work, where we just talk on the phone, unless that's an access issue. Another restriction for us is that, particularly with regards to Kim and Carrie's work, or with regards to loans where we're getting people's personal information, things have to be secure. We have to follow HIPAA. So we have to make sure to use platforms that have appropriate data security and allow us to take people's information in a way that's safe and appropriate.
Yeah, and we've stumbled across that before ourselves. So, I mean, trying to make all of this work is excessively complicated.
Yes.
How is the AT Lab funded?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the lab, as I said, we're a small team. It's just me, Kim, and Carrie, the two directors. We're housed in within Community Vision, which has been a nonprofit for a long time. They're entering their 31st year, which is very exciting. Here at the Seven Corners Collaborative, which is their new building. So the AT Lab is funded primarily by grants and donations, similarly to Community Vision. We take in we take on grants related to projects as well. So I mentioned our CARES Act funding, which is a grant to distribute assistive technology to support folks who have been impacted by COVID around isolation and disability. We also recently received a grant from the Oregon Community Foundation. And I also mentioned that our loan closet is funded by the Reeve Foundation. So I would say piecing together grants as well as individual donations or group donations is the bulk of the source of our funding. Kim and Carrie also do paid consultations. That's a part of their work. But that represents, I think, a relatively small chunk of our funding overall.
And do you also do paid consultations as well?
I don't. So their consultations are related specifically to their areas of specialization, occupational therapy and speech therapy. My role is to support our free programs, including the loan program and Open Lab. My specialization being like on the administrative side, on the sort of community focus side, I'm providing those sort of making connections to those free programs. So the AT Lab is located at the Seven Corners Collaborative, which is the building that Community Vision and all of its programs operate out of, as well as some other related organizations, including FACT Oregon, which is the parent information center, and the Northwest Access Fund has a desk there. So it's quite a lovely building, and someday we would love to give y'all a tour. We'll see how soon that is. The AT Lab's in the first floor, and the building, Seven Corners, is on where Division Ladd and Southeast 20th meet. It's at 2475 Southeast Ladd. Again, no open hours right now, but just for future reference. There are also videos on our website where you can get a virtual tour. So the AT Lab's website is www.cv-ATLAB, that's Community Vision -ATLAB, cv-ATLAB.org. And there you'll find information on our loan closet, some of our videos, informational videos, as well as tours to information on how to get AT. So we've just launched an AT funding page with some of that information, as well as our loan closet. And you can find our contact information there as well.
Ah, thank you. Do you also have a phone number?
Yes, our phone number is 503-292-4964.
Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule and come and talk to us and, you know, tell us all about the AT Lab and kind of inform us of what it does. Yeah.
Absolutely. This was such a treat. Thanks for having me. I had a great time chatting with you and would be happy to come back.
Yeah.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
Guess what? It's fall, so that means it's time for KBOO's annual membership meeting. Join us Saturday, November 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. via Zoom to hear updates about the station.